Soviet Union was now unraveling. Some Afghans and some Arab fighters pondered what you could do with money, Qurans, and a few good weapons. You could overthrow an infidel government. More important, you could destroy a superpower. They just had. It was now 1990. Chapter 3. Unfinished Mission. Unintended Consequences. Charlie Allen had his hair on fire. This is the way that Steve Simon, then head of the State Department Political Military Analysis Team, put it. You'd better talk to him. He thinks Iraq is really going to do it. By 1990, I had become the Assistant Secretary of State for Politico-Military Affairs. Charlie Allen was widely admired and disliked in CIA, and for the same reason, he was usually right. Now, as National Warning Officer, he was dissenting from the CIA's corporate view that Iraq was only intimidating Kuwait to affect oil prices. What makes you think it's real, Charlie? After all, it's 108 degrees out there, I teased Charlie Allen on the secure phone, knowing my quoting the CIA analysis would set him off. Don't believe those guys. They wouldn't notice if an Iraqi T-72 drew up in the CIA parking lot next to them. Allen's hair was on fire. Seriously, why do you think the Iraqis are up to something? Aren't they just trying to scare the Kuwaitis? I asked. MCON, was all Charlie said back. They're operating under MCON? No radio transmissions from their units? Hiding their locations, their movements? You don't do that if you're just trying to scare someone, I said. You got it, boyo. Allen knew he had made the sale. All right, I'll try to get a deputies committee, I said. Although it was not 108 degrees in our nation's capital, Washington felt like it, and most of the leadership had left town. Undersecretary of State Bob Kimmitt chaired the late afternoon meeting. Only Kimmitt, the National Security Council's Richard Haass, and I seemed concerned. CIA's deputy director, Dick Kerr, said there was no chance of an Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Admiral Dave Jeremiah agreed and refused my suggestion to retain U.S. forces that were leaving the area after an exercise. State's own Middle East Bureau had a report from our ambassador, April Glaspie, noting Saddam's reassurances to her. The meeting broke up without a sense of urgency. I went home. Steve Simon met me at my house, and we sat on the stoop and began to drain the bottle of Lagavulin. John Tritack, then a leading State Department analyst, joined us. As the second round was being poured, the telephone rang. John took it. You've got to go back in, Dick. The deputies committee is reconvening. Why? So we can all agree not to do anything again? I asked bitterly. John shook his head and grinned. No. Actually, it seems like there really is an Iraqi T-72 in the parking lot of the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. The principals returned to Washington. If we did nothing in response to Iraq seizing Kuwait, Saddam Hussein would think he could get away with seizing the Saudi eastern oil fields. If that happened, Baghdad would control most of the world's readily available oil. They could dictate to America. Reluctantly, Bush and his team decided that they needed to defend the Saudi oil fields. The mission to persuade the Saudi king to accept U.S. forces was given to Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. It was night when we landed in a steamy Jeddah and went to the king's palace. The Saudi princes sat on the opposite side of the wide room. The king was at the head of the U-shaped audience chamber. As we had agreed on the flight, Cheney began by saying that we thought the kingdom might be in danger. He concluded his presentation, promising that U.S. forces would come only to defend the kingdom. The king turned to his brothers and solicited their views. Despite our presence, a debate erupted over the very idea of having U.S. troops in the kingdom. They will never leave, one prince said in Arabic. Our interpreter whispered a translation. It violates Quranic principles, said another. The argument seemed to be going against us. What we then learned was that the king had received a report that a Saudi National Guard unit had stumbled upon an Iraqi army force near or slightly over the poorly marked Saudi border. Physically turning to his right, the king literally turned his back on his brothers and looked directly at Cheney. I trust President Bush. Tell him to have his army come. Come with all that they have. Come quickly. I have his word that they will leave when this is over. As we prepared to leave the palace, Cheney called a huddle. The Americans formed a tight circle in the foyer. Cheney said, Poker face is leaving here. All the cameras are out there, and they're going to be looking at your faces to see the king's decision. Don't let Saddam know. If he thinks we're coming in, he may jump off and seize the oil fields before we can get there. The Saudi princes left by another door. Some of them had thought of an alternative to the Americans. Unknown to the Americans at the time, the intelligence chief, Prince Turki, had been approached by the Saudi who had recruited Arabs to fight in the Afghan war against the Soviets, Osama bin Laden. When Kuwait was invaded, Osama had offered to make his fighters available to the king to defend Saudi Arabia, to drive Saddam out of Kuwait. Now, his help would not be required. He could not believe it. Letting non-believers into the kingdom? He feared the king had made a fatal mistake. But he did not break with the regime. He continued his work, transforming his front organization, the Afghan Services Bureau, into a network that linked returning Afghan war veterans in Algeria, Chechnya, Bosnia, Egypt, and the Philippines. Returning to the guest palace, Cheney sought to debrief the president. When the call did go through, Cheney's military assistant was told by someone that the president was in a meeting. Incredulous at the delays, Cheney's implacable facade cracked, and he finally erupted. Well, pull him out of the meeting! We may be going to war! The access agreements and pre-positioning that we had achieved to stop the Soviet Union were now being utilized for the first time, but to stop Iraq. In the months that followed, President Bush and Secretary of State Jim Baker knew that the thought of an American army going to war with an Arab nation could be enormously damaging to America's image in the Muslim world. They believed that the only way to inoculate against that damage was by extraordinary, unprecedented diplomatic effort and coalition building. Their historic efforts are in marked contrast to the go-it-alone, hell-bent-for-war policy pursued by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney 12 years later. When Bush's and Baker's diplomatic efforts failed to persuade Saddam Hussein to abandon Kuwait, the U.S. plan changed from defending Saudi Arabia to invading Kuwait. The Saudis supported the offensive plan, fearing the effects in their own country if hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops had to stay for years defending the kingdom against a possible Iraqi invasion. Once the ground war started, General Norman Schwarzkopf's plan for the invasion worked perfectly. Iraqi units began to flee Kuwait. But then, the pro-war tenor of U.S. news reporting began to change. American television carried stories of American aircraft slaughtering retreating Iraqi troops. Returning pilots were interviewed plainside, talking about turkey shoots. Schwarzkopf's view was that these withdrawing Iraqi troops were combat units with their equipment intact, repositioning. He wanted to eliminate them. Washington thought otherwise. The war was coming up on its 100th hour. Iraq was abandoning Kuwait. And there was no sense of risking adverse U.S. media coverage. Schwarzkopf was ordered to stop. Although he writes in his memoir that he agreed with the order, it seemed otherwise to some in his headquarters, who were sitting behind him on the secure phone, to me. There had never been a U.S. plan to march on Baghdad, nor an advocate in Washington for doing so. The Bush administration also shied away from the enormous task of occupying Iraq. How much would that cost? What Iraqi would we put in charge? What would we do with the Shia majority in Iraq? The Iraqis had now suffered hundreds of thousands of dead because of Saddam's lunacy. The Bush White House was convinced, wrongly, that Saddam would not last. It can and has been well argued as to whether the United States should have continued the war for a day or a week to destroy the Republican Guard, as had been originally intended. To me, it was obvious then and now that another 72 hours of combat was needed. Some even believe, wrongly, that we should have gone on to Baghdad. I can see how people can make that argument, although continuing into Baghdad would have shattered the coalition and left the U.S. holding the very messy bag of an occupied Iraq. What I cannot understand is how anyone can defend the Bush administration's decision to stand by and let the Republican Guard mass murder the Shia and the Kurds. If we had bombed the Republican Guard and defended the Shia and the Kurds, the Bush calculus that Saddam Hussein would fall without our occupying Baghdad might have proven to be true. Since we did not, a moral outrage was committed, and Saddam Hussein stayed in power. And the U.S. had to keep forces in Saudi Arabia to defend against a renewed strike on Kuwait by a reconstituted Republican Guard. Saudi dissidents who had protested the original U.S. presence now complained again that the American forces in the kingdom were a sacrilege. The Saudi government moved against the dissidents, threatening them with legal and economic punishments. Bin Laden was no exception to the government's crackdown. In Bin Laden's case, the government also threatened his extended family and its vast economic holdings. Invited to Khartoum by Hassan al-Turabi, the fundamentalist fanatic who had taken charge in Sudan, a bitter Bin Laden decamped across the Red Sea. Soon thereafter, he summoned his Afghan Arabs to join him. Saddam was still in power. UN weapons inspections in Iraq were being more restricted. U.S. forces were settling in throughout the Gulf. Osama bin Laden had broken with the Saudi regime and moved in with a radical state sponsor of terrorism. It was 1991. As the year ended, the Soviet Union ceased to exist as a legal entity. The Cold War had served to suppress some traditional ethnic and religious rivalries beneath the heavy glacier of the communist totalitarian state, particularly in the Balkans and Central Asia, where there were many Muslims. When the Cold War ended, the United States could move massively into the Persian Gulf during a crisis there. Ethnic and religious tensions could erupt in the Balkans and Central Asia, and religious fervor could no longer be directed at the communists. Those feeling disadvantaged by the global system and wishing to blame their lot on foreign forces had only one world-dominant nation to blame for their troubles, one major target to motivate their followers: America. Chapter 4. Terror Returns, 1993 to 1996. In 1993, the Clinton administration came to office with an agenda to deal with the post-Cold War era, and terrorism was not on it. Terrorism had not been a major issue in the preceding Bush administration either. George Herbert Walker Bush had issued no formal policy on counterterrorism and had chosen to deal with the single major anti-U.S. act of terrorism during his tenure, the bombing of Pan Am 103, through diplomacy, not the use of force. America seemed to be enjoying a period largely free of anti-American terrorism after the tumultuous years of the Reagan administration and its bombing of Lebanon and Libya. In January 1993, the new National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, had taken the unusual step of asking me to stay on in the White House when the Bush team left. Lake, on Madeleine Albright's advice, asked me to work on post-Cold War issues, such as peacekeeping, and failed states. While terrorism was in my portfolio of global issues, it was far down on the new team's priority list. All that was about to change, quickly. In my office, the large white telephone console blurted. I reached for the handset. "Did the Serbs do it?" It was Tony Lake. I had no idea what he was talking about. "Did the Serbs bomb it? Was it a bomb?" "I don't know yet, Tony." I faked it. "We're checking. Let me get back to you as soon as we have something. Soon." My next call was to the Situation Room. "Did something just get bombed?" "Well, something just exploded. We don't know if it was a bomb, sir." "The World Trade Center, sir," a young Navy officer replied. "I know you handle terrorism, sir, and we're supposed to tell you when something happens that might be terrorism, but do you want to know when things happen in the United States, too? Do you guys handle domestic crises, too?" The notion that terrorism might occur in the United States was completely new to us then. "Yes, yes, we do," I vamped, making up my view as I answered. "So what do we know about this explosion in New York?" "Well, sir, we're hearing it was a transformer that erupted, but we'll keep you posted." I turned to Richard Conyers, a DEA agent on my staff. "You know anyone in NYPD? Conyers used his law enforcement skills and White House clout to call through to the police commander on the scene at the World Trade Center. "Dick, I've got a deputy commissioner on the line. NYPD has its bomb guys down in the hole. They say it's definitely a bomb." Within days of the World Trade Center bombing, the FBI made an arrest. The FBI's magicians, the forensic specialists, had gone through the wreckage in the basement of the tower and determined what vehicle held the bomb. They were able to identify the specific Ryder rental truck and trace it back to a franchise in nearby northern New Jersey. Incredibly, the rental agency said the person who had rented the truck was scheduled to return the next day to collect the deposit on what he said was a stolen truck. With the arrest of Mohammed Salameh, the case broke open. A suspicious rental storage facility operator called the FBI to suggest that the terrorists might have used one of his lockers to prepare the bomb. Pulling on those strings of information, the FBI developed a list of the cell that had performed the bombing. Egyptians, a Jordanian, an Iraqi, a Pakistani. It was not the Serbs. The counterterrorism security group met. "Okay," I started. "So you know the names of the guys who did it. What's the group? Or to quote from a great movie, who are these guys anyway?" I was asking Bob Blitzer, who represented the FBI in the meeting. "Nobody we know," Blitzer answered, obviously chagrined. "New York thinks that there may be some links to the guy that shot a rabbi up there last fall. They all seem to be related to a Muslim preacher from Egypt, a guy in Brooklyn or Jersey City." "How did they get in?" I wondered. "What does their visa application say? Terrorist?" Blitzer explained. "Well, two of them just showed up at JFK last year without any documents or even false docs. One of the two was detained because he had a how-to-make-a-bomb manual on him." The other man was Ramzi Yosef. "So, let me get this straight. We let a guy go who was with a bomb builder. We let him get into a cab at JFK, even though he shows up here without a passport?" "Don't worry, Dick. We'll pick them all up," Blitzer assured me. "We'll track them down. We'll find out who they worked for." Within 2 weeks of the bombing, the FBI had taken four of the cell into custody. The cell leader, Ramzi Yosef, disappeared and became our most wanted terrorist. The New York investigation soon revealed a network that had supported the plotters. Spread across Brooklyn, Queens, and North Jersey, the network seemed to center on Omar Abdul Rahman, a blind Egyptian who served as a spiritual leader to Egyptian radicals. By keeping a close eye on Rahman, within months the FBI uncovered another cell planning bombings in New York. This time, it would be the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, the United Nations headquarters, and other landmarks. By the end of June 1993, the plotters and Rahman were in the federal government's Manhattan Metropolitan Detention Center. It seemed like the counterterrorism machinery was working well. It wasn't. The FBI and CIA should have been able to answer my question, who are these guys anyway? But still, they could not. The real answer was a group that FBI and CIA had not yet heard of, Al-Qaeda. The first member of Al-Qaeda arrested in the United States, as we later discovered, was El-Sayed Nasser, who, in New York in 1992, assassinated Rabbi Meir Kahane, the fiery leader of the radical Jewish Defense League. Nasser's legal bills were ultimately paid by Osama bin Laden. The four initially arrested for the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 were quickly linked to the Al-Kifa Center in Brooklyn. That center was funded by and openly affiliated with the Afghan Services Bureau, run by Osama bin Laden. Ramzi Yousef had even called bin Laden from New York. Osama bin Laden had formed Al-Qaeda 3 years earlier. Not only had no one in the CIA or FBI ever heard of it, apparently they had never heard of bin Laden either. As it happened, I was the one in Washington who first saw evidence of a true act of terrorism by Saddam Hussein against us. And the irony is that President Clinton's response to it successfully deterred Saddam from ever again using terror against the United States. I had the daily habit of reading hundreds of intelligence reports, embassy messages, and translations of foreign media that the Situation Room dutifully forwarded to my office computer. One day in April, I saw a subject line that grabbed my eye. An Arab-language newspaper in London was reporting that the Kuwaiti police had prevented an assassination attempt on former President Bush. There had been no such report from the Secret Service, FBI, CIA, or the American Embassy. Nonetheless, I called our ambassador in Kuwait, Ryan Crocker, a career officer and expert on the Arab world. "Ryan, have you seen this report in a London paper about an attempted assassination on former President Bush?" He had not seen it, but did tell me what a great time Bush had had in Kuwait. Then he paused. "Dick, knowing you, you could not possibly be instructing me to ask the Kuwaitis about the report, because you know, of course, that we're told never to accept instructions directly from White House staff." "As it happens, now that I know about the story, I might just ask someone I happen to be seeing tonight." The next morning, there was a sealed envelope on my desk, a message so sensitive that it could not be sent to me electronically from the Situation Room. It was a report from our ambassador in Kuwait, which stated that the Kuwaitis were covering up a plot that they had foiled. The plot was aimed at killing former President Bush, and had almost succeeded. Several people were being held, and they had implicated the Iraqi intelligence service. By early June, the CIA and FBI had corroborated the prisoner's story. On June 23rd, Tony Lake had in his office his usual Wednesday lunch with Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and Secretary of State Warren Christopher. During the lunch, he called and asked me to join them. "We'd like you to plan a retaliation mission against Iraq. Only you and one person each from Defense and State. When can we have the plan, the checklist?" Someone from CIA was added to the circle, and in a day, we had a target list developed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and CIA. Secretary Christopher argued strongly on legal grounds that the list be limited to one facility, the Iraqi intelligence headquarters. He also wanted it hit on Saturday night to minimize casualties. Christopher won. I put the checklist, a timeline, and the implementing documents in a book, and gave it to Lake on Friday. He looked at it and said, "That's good. Take it down and show the president. I'll tell him you're coming. Then, do it." National Security Council staff, even special assistants to the president like me, had not popped in on the president in my experience. Now I was being asked to go see the president about the first use of force in his administration. Presented with a detailed plan, Clinton was pragmatic. "Well, this may teach them a lesson, but if it doesn't, we'll have to do more." Shortly after 6 p.m. Saturday, a small group of senior administration officials began assembling in Lake's office. I went to the Oval Office to help the president with his last few calls notifying congressional leaders. The cruise missiles had just been launched. "So, when will we get the pictures from the missiles?" the president asked me. "Well, we don't get pictures from the missiles, sir, but we will have bomb damage images from satellites available to show you first thing in the morning," I explained. "Tomorrow morning? I'm going on TV in an hour to say we blew up this building. I want to know first that we did." I went back to Lake's office with the news. A glum mood settled over the office as we wondered how we would get the president to go on national television. Then, as we talked, he did. On all networks, the Saturday evening news anchors were told something and announced a surprise address by the president. "We don't know why," one said. Clinton read the short statement and then, almost immediately, showed up in Lake's office with Vice President Al Gore. "We thought you weren't going to go on," Lake confessed. "We thought you needed proof that the missiles had hit." Gore urged the president to tell us something that the two highest leaders in the land clearly found funny. "Okay, okay," Clinton agreed. "I needed relative certainty that the missiles had hit, and none of you guys could give me that. So I called CNN. They didn't have anybody in Baghdad tonight, but their cameraman in their Jordan bureau had a cousin or some relative who lived near the intelligence headquarters. So they called him." Most of us in the room looked horrified. The cousin said, "Yeah, the whole place blew up. He was certain. So I figured we had relative certainty." I was initially disappointed that the retaliation had been so small, the targets had been taken off the list, and that the raid was scheduled in the middle of the night when few Iraqi intelligence officers would be present. My friends from the first Bush administration told me vaguely that they had heard that the Bush family were also upset that the response was so limited. My disappointment faded with time because it seemed that Saddam had gotten the message. Subsequent to that June 1993 retaliation, the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement communities never developed any evidence of further Iraqi support for terrorism directed against Americans. Until we invaded Iraq in 2003. The first year of the Clinton administration also tested the new president's willingness to use force a second time, in Somalia. In retrospect, it is possible that the October Battle of Mogadishu may have been a second case of an al-Qaeda role in an attack on Americans. On October 3, 1993, in the famous Black Hawk Down incident, the militia of Somali warlord Farah Aidid shot down two helicopters with rocket-propelled grenades. When it was over, 18 Americans and probably 1,200 Somalis had been killed. When the National Security Council cabinet members met with the president in the cabinet room, Clinton sat silently, red-faced, listening to Secretary of State Warren Christopher, Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, and Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell. When they had talked themselves out, Clinton stopped doodling and looked up. "Okay, here's what we're going to do. We are not running away with our tail between our legs. I've already heard from Congress, and that's what they all want us to do. Get out tomorrow. We're staying. We're also not going to flatten Mogadishu to prove we are the big badass superpower. Everybody in the world knows we could do that. We don't have to prove that to anybody. We are going to send in more troops, with tanks and aircraft and anything else that they need. We are going to show force. And we are going to keep delivering the food. If anybody fucks with us, we will respond. Massively. And we are going to get the UN to finally show up and take over. Tell Boutros he has 6 months to do that. Not one day more. Then we will pull out. As the meeting broke up, Clinton indicated for Lake and me to follow him through the side door into the outer area of the Oval Office. I want us running this, not the State Department or the Pentagon. He looked at me. No more U.S. troops get killed. None. Do what you have to do. Whatever you have to do. 6 months later, the United States finally handed over the operation to the United Nations peacekeeping force. There had been no more American casualties. During those 6 months, I repeatedly pressed the CIA to track down rumors in the foreign press about terrorists who might have trained IDEED's militia. They discounted them. I asked my friends Mike Sheehan and Roger Cressy, who had worked in Mogadishu in 1993, what they thought. How the shit would CIA know? Mike replied. They had nobody in the country when the Marines landed. Then they sent in a few guys who had never been there before. They swapped people out every few weeks, and they stayed holed up in a U.S. compound on the beach, in comfy trailer homes that the Air Force flew in. Apparently, Sheehan and Cressy were right. Although the CIA did not know it in 1993 and 1994, evidence later emerged and was included in the U.S. indictment of bin Laden that al-Qaeda had been sending advisors to IDEED and had helped to engineer the shootdown of the U.S. helicopters. Thus, when the Clinton administration looked back on the terrorism of 1993, they did not include the events of Somalia in that category. Nor did they think about bin Laden or al-Qaeda, because they had not yet been told that the terrorist or his organization existed. Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, however, thought about the United States. Even though the U.S. had not cut and run under congressional pressure, they perceived that it had. The additional 6 months' stay and the orderly handoff to the UN had not impressed them. The failure to flatten Mogadishu had registered. Once again, they told one another, the United States had been humiliated by a third world country, just like Vietnam, just like Lebanon, just like the Soviets in Afghanistan. Was Clinton right not to respond with some large retaliation to the murder of the 18 U.S. commandos? We had killed over 1,000 Somalis in a day. Should we have done more? We could have kept up the hunt for our deed, but that would have placed the prestige of the United States against the resourcefulness of one man hiding in his own country. In retrospect, I doubt there was anything that could have been done then to deter al-Qaeda. Killing more innocent Somalis would not have helped. Although neither the CIA nor FBI had yet heard of al-Qaeda, by 1994, Clinton, Lake, and I believed our response to terrorism should be high on the list of measures to shape the post-Cold War world. Part of that response was developing a new policy on counterterrorism to replace what Reagan had signed 7 years earlier. I drafted and circulated a new policy for approval by all of the relevant departments and agencies, and soon President Clinton signed Presidential Decision Directive 39. U.S. Policy on Counterterrorism. It reiterated the no-concessions policy, which the Reagan administration had violated by trading arms to Iran for the release of American hostages. It called for both offensive and defensive actions in order to reduce terrorist capabilities and in order to reduce vulnerabilities at home and abroad. Law enforcement, intelligence, military, and diplomatic tools would be used and coordinated. Finally, there would be, quote, no greater priority than preventing the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction by terrorists, unquote. Or, if that failed, there would be no greater priority than removing that capability. The new policy sounded good, but it depended on intelligence that remained spotty. The search for the two remaining World Trade Center bombers continued in 1994, with Ramzi Youssef getting the most intensity. Unknown to us at the time, he engaged in unsuccessful plots to kill the Pope and later President Clinton, both in the Philippines. Then in January 1995, Manila police responded to a fire in an apartment building. The message from Manila popped up on my computer screen on a Saturday morning. I printed it and ran from my office in the executive office building across the parking lot, known as West Exec, to the West Wing. I interrupted a meeting Tony Lake was having on Bosnia and announced, "They found Ramzi Youssef." "That's great news," Lake replied. "No, it's not. He got away," I exhaled. "And he was planning to blow up U.S. airliners in the Pacific with bombs smuggled on board, bombs we wouldn't notice, using liquid explosives. They're assembled on board in the bathroom and then left there. The terrorist then gets off at the first stop and the plane continues on and blows up. The Filipinos found some of the bombs, but not all. He had the flights all picked out. United, Northwest, 11 of them. 747s. Lake got the image. U.S.-owned airlines with flights in the Pacific were told to ground them. Flights in the air were turned around. Nothing was found. Ramzi Youssef had again eluded capture. The counterterrorism security group had already decided to issue a reward for Youssef and had authorized the distribution of matchbooks throughout the Middle East and South Asia, noting our $2 million bounty. There was a flood of people claiming to know where he was and seeking the reward. Virtually all of them were worthless leads. In early February, however, one of the callers actually did know. In the early morning hours of the day on which Ramzi Youssef planned to take a bus from Pakistan to Afghanistan, he was rudely awakened by Pakistani and American officers. A few days later, he was back in New York. After his arrest, Ramzi Youssef became a man of as much mystery and attention as when he was at large. With almost every terrorist incident or similar event, an urban legend develops that challenges the official story. With Ramzi Youssef, the legend was that there were actually two people. One was the man arrested by the FBI in Pakistan, and the other was a mastermind of Iraqi intelligence, the Muhabarat. This legend was part of the theories of Laurie Milroy. Milroy's thesis was that there was an elaborate plot by Saddam to attack the United States, and that Youssef was his instrument. Her writing gathered a small cult following, including the recently relieved CIA director Jim Woolsey and Paul Wolfowitz. More than anyone in the Clinton administration, I wanted an excuse to eliminate the Saddam Hussein regime. More than anyone, I wanted the World Trade Center attack to be an Iraqi operation, so we could justify reopening the war with Iraq. But there was no good evidence leading to Baghdad's culpability. By 1994, there was a lot of evidence beginning to point to another organization, whose name and outline was still unknown, but which involved a man the CIA kept referring to as terrorist financier Osama bin Laden. 2 months after Ramzi Youssef's arrest on a Sunday afternoon in March, I got the news that there had been a terrible explosion in downtown Oklahoma City. It had terrorism written all over it. But in Oklahoma? I called the White House from Haiti and reached my deputy, Steve Simon, in the Situation Room. He stepped out of a counterterrorism security group meeting to take the call. I felt guilty interrupting the meeting. "Who's chairing the meeting while you're talking to me?" I asked. "Oh, don't worry, it's in good hands," Simon answered dryly. "Bill Clinton's chairing." My only advice was to not assume the bombing in Oklahoma City was by an Arab or Islamic group. It didn't smell right. Hours later, it became clear that the bombing was done by Americans. The president's repeated assurances and speeches after the Oklahoma City bombing did much to comfort a shaken nation. but also to focus it on the problem of terrorism. Clinton decided to seek more legal authority and more money to increase our ability to go on the offensive against terrorism. Chapter 5, The Almost War, 1996. If the Clinton National Security Team had come to office in 1993 without a thought to terrorism, by the beginning of 1996 they were preoccupied with it and feared a major terrorist attack would happen in the year ahead. But it wasn't Al-Qaeda they expected would attack. The radical theocracy that had replaced the Shah of Iran in 1979 had not cooled in its zealotry. Although the American hostages in Tehran were released at the beginning of 1980, the regime continued on a path of action against America. Evidence mounted of Iran's procurement of modern weapons and materials to make chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. The White House and the State Department launched a concerted effort to persuade allies to cut economic ties with Iran, although to little avail. Not content with administrative action, as 1995 ended, Congress passed additional statutory sanctions against Iran and a secret appropriation to fund covert action by the CIA aimed at the Iranian regime. That secret leaked in the Washington Post a month later, in January 1996. The Post report alleged that a small amount, $18 million, had been added at the insistence of Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. It said that Gingrich had wanted the funds to overthrow the Iranian regime, but had settled with the administration on language that would permit the funds to be used to change the behavior of the government in Tehran. The story set off alarms throughout the Iranian hierarchy. In a mirror image of the U.S. action, the Iranian Majlis, or parliament, publicly passed funding for covert action against the United States. The Majlis action was largely a propaganda move. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and Ministry of Intelligence and Security were already actively engaged in anti-U.S. efforts around the world. Fearing Iranian-sponsored terrorism against the United States, the Counterterrorism Security Group formed a team to examine what Iran might do and how we could move to deter and prevent attacks. One possible target we considered was the International Olympics, planned for August 1996 in Atlanta. The FBI said it was the lead federal agency for the security of the Olympics and had been planning for the event for over a year. So I asked it to brief the Counterterrorism Security Group in April. The briefing was short and uninformative. The FBI-led team could not answer most of the questions thrown at them. I wondered how we would ever get the departments in Washington to do the right thing about Atlanta Olympic security. A week later, the Vice President of the United States was in a short motorcade up Pennsylvania Avenue to the headquarters of the FBI. A large flag room on the first floor had been set up for a counterterrorism security group meeting, in which every department would present a briefing on plans for their role in Atlanta Olympic security. I sent the word to the departments that I would not be chairing the meeting that day. Gore would be. The level of attendance rose. In the car on the way to the J. Edgar Hoover building, I painted the picture for Gore one more time. "Here are some questions you might ask, innocently," I said, passing a list to him. "Then, after a while, you ought to look really mad." "I do mad well," Gore smiled. After the introductions and a few of the briefings, Gore slipped the questions out of his suit jacket. "Well, I know you all have briefings, but let me just ask a few questions that have been troubling me." The answers had not gotten any better. "Look, guys," the vice president said, "I know General Shelton over there could probably personally scare away most terrorists, but we can't put Hugh on every corner. We need a better plan than this." Turning to me on his right, Gore handed me all the authority I needed. "Dick, I'm going to ask you to pull all that together. Use whatever resources these agencies have that are needed Anybody got any problems with that? We were off to the races. By May, we had a plan to move several thousand federal personnel and their equipment into facilities in and around Atlanta, at a cost that ran into scores of millions of dollars. Yet, much to our chagrin, we failed to stop a lone bomber from striking at the Olympics. I had heard a rumor that FBI had someone in custody, and called a friend at the Bureau's command center. "They got a guy, all right. Louis Free is on the phone now, telling Atlanta what questions to ask him. Free thinks it's him." His tone suggested there was more to it. I asked, "So what do you think?" "Atlanta doesn't like the guy for the bomb. He's a rent-a-cop who was at the scene. But don't say we don't know who did it, 'cause Louis has decided." The rent-a-cop was named Richard Jewell. After his life was ruined by the negative publicity of the detention and media leaks by the FBI, Jewell was released. The real bomber turned out to be Eric Rudolph, who went on to commit several other acts of terrorism. Rudolph was arrested by local police in 2003. In May 1996, shortly before the Atlanta Olympics, word reached Washington of a remarkable discovery made by the Belgian authorities. They had intercepted a shipment en route to Germany. Inside what was labeled as pickles was a custom-designed weapon best described as the largest mortar ever seen. The weapon was designed to lob a large explosive charge a short distance, such as over the walls of an Israeli or U.S. embassy compound. The shipment was traced to Iran. The Defense Department agreed to our request to station an additional aircraft carrier battle group in the waters off Iran temporarily as a deterrent signal to Tehran. The Navy relied on two ports in the Persian Gulf. One was the U.S. Navy base on the island nation of Bahrain. There, thousands of U.S. sailors lived and worked. Bahrain was ruled by the Khalifas, a Sunni Muslim family. More than half of Bahrain's citizens were, however, Shia Muslims, who felt disenfranchised by the Khalifas. They provided fertile ground for Iran. In early June, the Bahraini ambassador to Washington called me and asked, on behalf of his foreign minister, for an urgent meeting at the White House. He presented me with pictures of bombs and other weapons that had been found in Bahrain the day before. He handed over a document outlining a plot by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps to stage an armed attack on the Khalifas and install a pro-Iranian government in Bahrain. Although little noticed by the Western press, the attempted coup in Bahrain was further evidence of Iran's support for terrorism and its attempt to drive the U.S. military out of the region. In 2 weeks, we had still more. The American military had come to Saudi Arabia in August 1990 and was still there in 1996. The U.S. Air Force had been given a high-rise housing complex near the village of Khobar. On June 25, 1996, it was attacked by terrorists using a devastating truck bomb. 19 Americans died. In fact, Khobar was the second attack on a U.S. military facility in Saudi Arabia. In November 1995, the Riyadh headquarters of the U.S. military training mission to the Saudi National Guard had been bombed, killing 5 Americans. Within days, the Saudi authorities had arrested 4 men, obtained their confessions, and executed them. The Saudis provided scant details about who they were or why they had acted. To avoid a repeat, I asked Clinton to write to the king, seeking full cooperation in a joint investigation of the Khobar attack and announcing that he was sending an FBI team. I met with the National Security Council staff counterterrorism team. We went over every CIA, NSA, Defense, and State Department report on threats in Saudi Arabia for the past 2 years. A few dozen reports, culled from thousands on file, told a clear story. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps' special branch, called the Quds Force, the Jerusalem Force, had created Hezbollah groups in Bahrain, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. They had secretly recruited terrorists and sent them off for training in Iran and then in Lebanon. Saudi Arabia had learned of this activity and protested to Iran. The Saudis had told us none of this. The day after the Khobar attack, we presented Tony Lake with a detailed report placing the blame on Iran's Quds Force and their front, Saudi Hezbollah. Lake believed us and wondered why the CIA had not reached the same conclusion. He sent the report to CIA Director John Deutsch, who replied only that ours was one of many theories. At the FBI, Director Louis Free responded eagerly to the White House request for an FBI investigation. It was one of the few times Free did anything eagerly that the White House had asked him to do. Free told senior FBI officers that the White House staff were all politicals who could not be trusted. Soon after the Khobar attack, Free was sought out by Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar. Bandar charmed Free at frequent meetings at the Saudis' Virginia estates. Behind the glad hand, the Saudis had no intention of cooperating with the FBI. The attack had revealed an internal vulnerability in the kingdom. The Saudis did not want that embarrassment publicly revealed. Free sought to understand from Prince Bandar why the FBI was not getting better cooperation from the Saudi government. I learned that Bandar had explained to Free that the White House did not want the Saudis to cooperate with Free. Clinton, Bandar claimed, did not want the evidence that Iran had bombed an American Air Force base. Clinton did not want to go to war with Iran. Free believed it. It fit with his own dim view of the president. In the White House, we heard that Free began telling congressmen and reporters of the supposed Clinton cover-up. Free should have been spending his time fixing the mess that the FBI had become. An organization of 56 Princetons, the 56 very independent field offices, without any modern information technology to support them. He might have spent some time hunting for terrorists in the United States, where Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had put down roots, where many terrorist organizations were illegally raising money. Instead, he reportedly chose to be chief investigator in high-profile cases like Khobar, the Atlanta Olympic bombing, and the possible Chinese espionage at our nuclear labs. In all of those cases, his personal involvement appeared to contribute to the cases going down dark alleys, empty wells. His back channels to Republicans in the Congress and to supporters in the media made it impossible for the president to dismiss him without running the risk of making him a martyr of the Republican right, and his firing a cause celeb. In actuality, Clinton had been pursuing the opposite path to what Free imagined. In discussions with Saudi officials, the U.S. made very clear, at presidential direction, that there must be full cooperation, not the rapid decapitation of suspects, as had been done in the Riyadh case.